A little while ago, I got to have lunch with Kwame Onwuachi, chef of the restaurant Kith & Kin in Washington, D.C.
Oh my God. I know you just told me what I'm eating right now, but all I can say is like, what am I even eating right now? This is, oh.
We were in his apartment, which is a very nice apartment, which he shares with his fiance and their dog. But you can definitely tell it is a chef's apartment. There is a whole room with no furniture, and you just know he doesn't spend a whole lot of time hanging out at home. Outside his window, you could see just construction cranes everywhere, and it's fancy condo building after fancy condo. It's like the garden of fancy condo buildings, and it's spring, and they're all just sprouting up. It's in a neighborhood of Washington, D.C. that honestly looks like it was all built yesterday, and I couldn't help but think it's kind of a perfect metaphor for how the world thinks of Kwame. He's still in his 20s, and he's everywhere right now. This spring, he was named a Best New Chef by Food & Wine magazine. He's a finalist for the Rising Star Chef Award from the James Beard Foundation, and he's got a memoir that just came out called Notes from a Young Black Chef. And all that sounds great, but it also means he's got a lot of people pretty ready to throw some water on his fire. He's too young. He hasn't paid his dues. They read the title of his book and go, what's being black got to do with anything? You just came out of nowhere, and excuse me, who are you? But did he just come out of nowhere?
So we're eating curried goat. So we've marinated the goat in green seasoning. Mm-hmm. So green seasoning is a Trinidadian marinade. They have celery, green onions, ginger, garlic. We do our fermented scotch bonnet. Chilies. You marinate the goat in that for about 28 hours.
28.
Yeah. Not 29. Those extra 4 hours.
Not 24. 28.
And you sear it, and then we braise it in chicken stock and let that reduce.
And why are we eating this today?
Because this represents one of my earliest food memories was curried goat. My grandfather is from Trinidad, and my grandmother had it in the fridge. I remember her opening the fridge, heating up some roti in a paper towel, and then like unraveling the paper towel and steam billowing out from it. And then she wrapped the curry goat in the roti and then put it in my mouth. And it was like one of those like aha moments at a very young age.
Kwame's food is about a lot more than just what cool chefy ideas he has. It's about his grandparents in Trinidad. It's about his grandparents in Nigeria. It's about his mother's Louisiana Creole cooking. It's about growing up running with gangbangers and selling drugs to pay for college. It's about waking up one day strung out, seeing that a black man had just been elected president of the United States, and realizing he was meant for more than just smoking weed and slinging pills. It's about being a star on TV, opening an incredibly hyped restaurant, and having it all crash down before he's even 28, and it's about making a comeback, cooking the food of black people from around the world in a world where comebacks are not readily given to young black men.
Let's go to this. What's this?
So
this other dish?
This is a variation of my mother's shrimp. So my mother is famous in our family for her peel and eat shrimp.
Oh my God, dude. Oh my God.
Yeah. So she takes shrimp and sautés it in this house spice that she makes, and a little bit of garlic and thyme, and that's it, and butter. So I've taken that same idea, and we use the same house spice that she makes. We sear the shrimp in that, and then we put the shrimp off to the side. Now the sauce, I feel like, was the best part. You know, we would dip bread into this like butter, garlic, house spice sauce. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to think like, how can I impart as much flavor into that while still keeping, you know, tradition alive and not like bastardizing her dish. So I took Worcestershire, orange juice, white wine, Abita beer, shrimp crustacean stock. So at the restaurant, we do king crab, we do lobsters, we do shrimp. Yeah. So we take all of that and caramelize all those shells and make a crustacean stock from that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we add that all together with the Holy Trinity, like the Trinity from Louisiana. So
green pepper, celery.
Yeah. And then we reduce that down to a paste. And then we deglaze the pan with the shrimp stock from when we seared the shrimp. And then add that paste back to it, let that reduce. and then mount it with butter, lemon, some more house spice.
Oh my God. I know you just told me what I'm eating right now, but all I can say is like, what am I even eating right now? This is, oh, Ma Dukes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
And the best part is we keep the heads on. So all those, all that juice in the head, you get to suck on the heads like we do in Louisiana. And it's like the best. This dish and when we have gumbo on the menu is what I eat all the time.
Yeah, this is, I just feel like I just took a trip to Louisiana and came back and decided to go back around and go again. So thank you to your mother, Jewel. This is just bananas. And actually, I want to start by asking you about your mother. When I read in the book, you grew up largely in your mother's home and moved around a lot. But in one of the homes that you grew up in with her, I remember this really amazing scene. You're in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
She did a lot of cooking at home. She had her catering company, right? So she did all of her catering gigs was just like cooking out of her like apartment kitchen in the Bronx. And I was reading that and thinking, God, your neighbors just must, they must feel some kind of way about the smells coming out of your home. But then you have this great moment where you talk about how your mother and you would walk around your building in the hallways and just smelling what all the neighbors cooked and would knock on their doors and be like, hey, what are you making? Show me what that is. So who were those neighbors and what were they making?
So one of them was an Indian household.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, I don't know, four floors down. We smelled it all the way up on the sixth floor. And we're sitting in the kitchen. We both were just hit with the smell. Like it creeps up like the cartoons, you know, into the window, into our nostrils. Like, you know, like a Tom and Jerry episode. And me and my mom are both like, whoa, what is that? That smells so good. And meanwhile, it's been a couple times like a month. We're like taking the elevator up and we're smelling this strong scent.
Yeah.
And at that time, we had it. We're like, we're going to go find this. Like we're in the apartment. We're going to go find this. So we race out the room, go to the elevator. It's not on our floor. We know that for a fact. We get in the elevator. We press all the buttons. They all light up. And fifth floor. Run out there, letting our nose lead us. Like, all right, it's not the fifth floor. Okay, let's get back in the elevator. Fourth floor, go out there. It's not the fourth floor. Third floor, it's not the third floor. Second floor, ding, open the elevator doors, get out, and it's like it's curry.
Here it is.
Yeah, here it is. So we can follow our nose to like this one door at the end of the hallway, and we knock on the door, and this lady opens up, small, short, like Indian woman, elderly woman, and she's like, can I help you? And I think she thinks she's going to get yelled at or like complaining about the smell once again. And my mom just like, hey, my name's Jewel. This is my son. We smelled your curry from the sixth floor. I don't really know how to say this, but, you know, here I am. Like, can we try a bowl of your curry? And the lady's like, yes, come on, come in. And she sits us down. She has like paratha like stacked up. She has this bowl of like simmering curry and she ladles a couple bowls for us with some roti and we go to town on it. And you know, those are the moments I lived for when I was a kid, just like exploring and just being in the moment, you know, and not worrying about like, okay, what is this person gonna think I'm crazy? Like, I just want to try a curry. It's a yes or no situation.
Yeah.
Is it a no? Because I'll leave. If it's a yes, let's go.
Yeah.
And that lady eventually became my babysitter. And I was able to eat that all the time. So that was a great part about that.
And you had other neighbors too. You had like,
Yeah, we had, you know, Puerto Rican neighbors, you know, Dominican neighbors, Albanian. You know, we had the whole gamut. But that was the one, you know, with the strongest smell coming from behind the doors.
I love that story because I feel like when they hear, oh, Kwame Onwuachi grew up in the Bronx, tough upbringing, yada, yada, that's not the first thing people think of when they think of what growing up in the Bronx is like.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I love about your story and I love about your book and just the way that you've always told your story is how it's about showing the reality of your life, but also like exploding the stereotypes that people assume, exploding the stereotypes of what people think apply to you. That said, there's a lot that, you know, of your upbringing that is less charming and sweet and friendly than that. And I think about the fact that you went to a school where the teachers were afraid of the students. Mm-hmm. And you went to work on a boat, which is obviously a really hard thing, and you were a cook, and you were like the only black person on this boat full of, you know, kind of tough white laborers. Mm-hmm. And when you were younger, you ran with the gang. And I think of all these situations of your story where you were surrounded by people who probably felt like they had to be hard to be respected. Mm-hmm. Like you had to have a killer mentality. Mm-hmm. Is that you?
It's a great question. I think it's not something that I generally think of. I think growing up in New York City toughens you as a kid, because you have to, everything is a journey. Even as an adult in New York City, everything's a journey. You have to wake up, okay, is the train gonna be delayed? All right, let me get on this train, there's a delay. Now I have to get out and catch a cab. Now I'm stuck in traffic. Like, everything is a journey with what you're doing. There's no, like, just straight point A to point B. As a kid, it's even, I think, more difficult, you know, growing up in that environment and having to navigate, am I going to get beat up if I walk on this side of the street? Am I wearing the right colors? Am I going through this street? You know, make sure I don't look anybody in the eye. Like, look down. Right. Have this facade or face up that shows I'm not to be messed with. Right. So no one messes with you. Right. So I think that changes you growing up, you know, in New York or any major city.
That's Chef Kwame Onwuachi. His new book is called Notes from a Young Black Chef. We'll be back with more of Kwame's stories about being sent to live in Nigeria as a kid and how he found himself on a boat with sweaty oil workers in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. We're spending this episode with Kwame Onwuachi, author of Notes from a Young Black Chef. When we last left our hero, he was talking about how growing up in a tough city can change you in ways both big and small. And there's a story in the book about the first time he punched someone. And it was a fight he didn't want to have, but he clocked that boy straight in the face. And then he just went in. He felt a rush, and he knew that violence was a part of him now. And it was a moment that I think his mother probably feared would happen, because a few years before that, she tried to get him out of his neighborhood and sent him to live with his grandfather in Nigeria, which is where we pick up our story. And I asked Kwame what that was like.
Well, it was shocking, for one. Don't get me wrong, I was excited to go to Nigeria, you know? Yeah. It was cool to go there for the summer. I haven't been there in so long. Some of my cousins were out there.
Your grandfather lived there.
My grandfather lived there, yeah. So we went out there together. We actually left from D.C. My grandfather used to teach at Howard University. Mm. So a lot of my aunts live here in D.C. So when he comes from Nigeria, the tradition is you stay with your eldest child. So he stays with my aunt here. So we all used to come down from Jersey, New York, wherever we were, to stay with my grandfather here in D.C. every summer. So this time, when I came down, we got on a plane back to Nigeria together.
Wait,
Union Station is over there. So we get to Nigeria, and it's cool, you know. We're in a small little village. I'm down, you know, for a couple weeks in Nigeria. And then we go to a call center because their cell phones, like, weren't really big then. So we had to go to a call center, an internet cafe, to like make a phone call. So we drive, you know, an hour in my, you know, grandfather's old rinky dink Mercedes, and then my legs are sticking to the leather, burning. Finally get there, talk to my mom, and she tells me, you're staying until you learn respect. And I was like, how long? What does that mean? School starts, like, in a couple weeks. It's almost September. She's like, I'll let you know when you can come back.
Mm. How old were you?
I was 10 years old. So from 10 to 12, I was in Nigeria learning respect. So everything changed, you know? I went from playing PlayStation to doing my homework under kerosene lamp. You know, there wasn't electricity, there wasn't running water. you know, school was completely different. You were still disciplined in school, mm-hmm. you know, physically. So if you didn't do your homework, it was like 7 lashes from like a cane. Mm. You know, if you acted up in class, you had to carry a cinder block back and forth on the soccer field. If you got into a fight or stole something, there wasn't like, there's no suspension. Suspension is a luxury. So you would dig your height. No one would ever complete that.
I was like, it took me a second to even understand what you were saying. No, dig your height. Like yeah, literally you dig a hole.
Stand in a hole yeah. that was taller than you. And the kids would be crying like when it got halfway here, like, no more, no more. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Think about that next time you want to fight someone over a pencil or, you know, you want to curse at a teacher.
Yeah.
Or you want to skip school, you know, think about these things. So it was real tangible lessons.
Yeah. Think about digging that.
Pound for pound. It's like, oh, you're going to do this? Okay, well, then you're going to do that. You know, it was it's interesting.
Yeah. But you ate well, too.
Not at first. I didn't eat. I was went on a hunger strike, essentially. So I ate these things called cheesies. They were like Cheetos in Nigeria and ground nuts, which are like peanuts.
Yeah.
But like a lot nuttier. And I ate those for like 2 months straight. That's all I ate. Mm. And I remember it was like 2 months later. It was okra stew. Mm. Okra stew with pounded yam. So pounded yam is like cassava, like large tubers of cassava they take and they put in a mortar and pestle, like a giant mortar and pestle with a little bit of water and between their legs and they pound it until it like gets like glutinous almost mm-hmm. where you can like grab it and like dip it into a stew similar to this and eat it. And one of the first meals when I got there was that was the meal. And my grandmother plopped it down on the plate, lifted the spoon up, and there was a string from the plate 3 feet up.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn, you're like just sticking. I was like, there's no way you're, it was the okra, the slime from the okra. I was like, there's no way you're getting me to eat that. Like, I'm not eating that. So I would eat the cheesies. And then 2 months later, she made that. And I was like, you know what? I'm tired of eating cheesies and peanuts. So I ate it and it was one of the most delicious things I ever put in my mouth. So then I started eating all the stews. I would eat onion stew. I was already keen to egusi stew because it was one of like my earliest food memories. My mother loved the stew. My father loved the stew. She would always cook it.
Egusi stew is made with like almost like a ground pumpkin seed, right?
Exactly, yeah. Ground melon seed, crayfish, iru, which is like a fermented locust bean.
Mm.
And
so it has almost like, almost in the way we use like a miso or
exactly,
like a soy sauce, right?
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And then like whatever stock you want to use. So usually like stockfish stock or chicken stock. And then that's the dish. And then bitter leaf or people use spinach here.
Yeah.
So it's delicious. There's nothing like it, egusi stew. And yeah, I started eating all the different types of stew. Benga stew from like the palm kernels. We would go and harvest from the palm trees and like soak these palm kernels and beat them in the mortar and pestle and then squeeze out, you know, all of the pulp. And then we'd separate palm oil. So we'll have that to cook with. And then the bulk of like the palm kernel puree. And we make benga soup from that. And I got into all these different, you know, Nigerian dishes.
Yeah.
That
it also sounds like respect for the land.
Yeah. Like, I mean, we raised our own chicken. There was no like Super Bowl wing party. If you wanted, you know, a 40 bucket of wings, you had to kill 20 chickens. You know, there was a real tangible.
A real bad time in the hen house.
Yeah.
Some want to flutter
football season. Yeah. We're stocking up, but it's like that was the thing that Africa taught me. There are like real consequences for pretty much everything. Or like if you want something, you're going to have to work for it.
Yeah.
So.
But then after this, you went back to the Bronx
mm-hmm.
And you went to Louisiana. You were coming out of a rough personal moment and you got a job as a cook on a boat. Tell us about that.
So the experience of the boat, I mean, it was life changing. I remember being in Louisiana, working with my mom in New Orleans, and there's a lot of temp people that came in and out of the catering company.
Yeah.
There was one kid that came in, was like, yeah, I'm only here for a week and I'm going right back on the boat. And I was like, what do you mean going back on the boat? What does that mean?
Yeah.
And he was like, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. They're like paying crazy amounts of money to go out there and cook for like 2 weeks. Mm. You 2 weeks on and you get 1 week off. So I'm here, I'm still making money on my week off, and I'm gonna go back there. And I was like, can you like hook me up with this? And he was like, yeah, it's they take anybody. Yeah. Just sign up. They're looking for anyone to go out there. There's like 30 boats out there. So the way it works is there's boats all along the East Coast and West Coast that clean up oil spills, whether they're small or large, from Maine to Florida. So they have all these responders that came together because it's the largest oil spill that happened in American history, one of the. So you had your Maine responder, you had your Texas responder, you know, all down here in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
And they needed cooks to go on these boats to cook for all the oil spill.
Literally just to feed all these people. Just to feed all these
people. Thousands of people. Thousands of people that were in the Gulf of Mexico cleaning up. So all the people that worked on the boats, though, were from those little string. You look at the map of Louisiana and you see all those hairs like coming off the end of it, and you have to zoom in and keep zooming in, and it's literally like a road and water on both sides.
Yeah,
those are where those people really came from. It's home of Louisiana.
Yeah.
So I called, got the job immediately. They were like, can you start in 3 days? I was like, yeah. They're like, we'll have a car waiting for you, or you can drive down. My mom was like, if I'm gonna send you out there to the Gulf of Mexico, I'm gonna drive you down to see where you're going.
Yeah.
You know. So we get on the road, we drive down, we're on this small little strip of road. Like, it's freaky. Like, we're driving and to the left and right is just water. And we get to the end and there's a small little boat waiting for me there. Says goodbye. I get on the boat, 3 hours into the Gulf until we hit the actual responder that I'm supposed to be on, is the main responder.
Yeah.
So we had to, I had to swing on a rope from one boat to the next boat. It was like some Peter Pan shit. It was crazy. So I swing on the rope. I jump off. I have to throw my luggage to the guys and waiting
fairy for fairy dust in your bag.
Fairy dust. Captain Hook is standing there. No, so I'm waiting there. And all of these guys, I mean, they honestly look like the most country people I've ever seen in my life. Like, country white people I've ever seen in my life. Like, you know, ripped shorts and, you know, oil smeared on their faces. Like, it was it was a scene. And I immediately instantly regretted this choice. I was like, I made the wrong turn. I made the wrong turn in life. This is my fault. I've got 2 weeks till I can get the hell out of here. So I get there and there's really this, I meet the chef for the first time and he's like, I got two questions for you. I'm like, what? He's like, do you know how to cook and do you know how to read?
You're gonna read.
And I was like, I'm not talking to you. And I walk out. And he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. I don't mean to be racist or anything. I'm just saying, like, people that come on this boat, like, they don't know how to hold a knife and they can't read a recipe. So, like, it's not about you. It's about, like, kind of like you all in general. I can clearly tell you're educated now that I've talked to you. Uh-huh. And I was like, all right, man. Like, we're going to do this. I'm here. All of the things that I thought were coming true. I got 2 weeks. I'm going to get through this. So essentially, the way the ship worked was there's a sous chef and a lead chef. So he assumed the lead chef position. He's been there for a while. He told me, you're my sous chef. You do things my way. And I obliged. I was like, I'm here for 2 weeks, and this job is pretty much over. So funny enough, so that guy's, I don't remember, I think he was from Texas. His name was Tex. The other guys, the other guys that I was initially actually scared of were some of the nicest people I've met in my life. Yeah. Like, we bonded, whereas like a entertainment room where there was like a Nintendo Wii and like Super cassettes Mario and DVDs. Yeah, then like Wii Tennis brings people together like nobody's business. But also we bonded over movies like Colors. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
Colors.
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 Colors. Colors. Colors. Colors.
Yeah. I remember watching that vividly with them. and a lot of South Park, and it was a good time when I was out of the kitchen. But when I was with him, I mean, I could barely call what he was doing cooking. Until one point, because I had gotten so close to him, I was like, I just want to cook for you guys. And I was like, you know what? I'll cook my food. You cook your food. We'll rotate.
We're talking to text.
To text, yeah. So I'll do breakfast, lunch. You'll do, you know, dinner, breakfast. And we'll, like, you know, kind of just
stay out of each other's way.
Exactly. So I remember the first dish I cooked. It was similar to this. It was shrimp etouffee. And I was so excited, you know, like, made my own house spice. I like made my own shrimp stock. I spent all day cutting like the Trinity perfectly and sweating those down. And by the time I put it up, you know, the word got out that I was making shrimp etouffee, and they were like, "This better be delicious, or we're going to end you," because I've been eating shrimp etouffee my entire life, and I mean, I just follow my mother's recipe, you know. Everything I've seen her do, I did the same exact thing.
Yeah.
These guys loved it. You know, it was like finally a little bit of piece of home for them.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And that was, you know, I wouldn't say that was my aha moment, but that was one of the times it clicked for me. Like, that cooking, one, really isn't about you as a person that's cooking. It's about the people that you're sharing it with.
Yeah.
But how impactful it can be. A meal can make someone's day or it can ruin someone's day.
Yeah.
It's the one of the times a lot of people have to themselves where no one's talking, you know? They can be talking, but like if everyone's eating, you're focused on your plate, you're like, this is really good, you know, and you're in your own zone. And it was a beautiful moment for me, you know. Tex didn't really take it too well. He started to try to sabotage me after that, and I remember I used to make cakes and he would throw them away, and it was messy, but they didn't invite Tex back to the boat after he had his 1 week off. And when I came back, they made me the lead chef, and then I got a sous chef, and it was a great experience. So
that's Kwame Onwuachi, and his book is called Notes from a Young Black Chef. We'll be back to hear more about how his star rose and fell and rose again, and why he thinks race has a lot to do with it. Welcome back to our talk with the chef Kwame Onwuachi. We spent an afternoon at his home talking and eating and occasionally wrestling with his dog.
Oh, the dog's here.
Yeah. Hey, Clove. Very sweet.
Hey, he just wants some love.
I mean, that dog can open doors. I mean, literally, Kwame would keep putting him back in the bedroom, and then you'd hear, wah, and he'd throw his paw on the handle, and then he'd out again. Anyway, so after Kwame found his calling as a cook, he hustled hard. He started his own catering company back in New York, went to culinary school, cooked in some of the best restaurants in the city, started doing pop-ups, moved to D.C., had a star turn on Top Chef, and then opened the Shaw Bijou. His debut restaurant, tasting menu only, incredibly ambitious, and D.C. was humming with excitement for it. Until they saw that right out of the gate, it would be one of the most expensive restaurants in the city, and then people started asking, wait, who do you think you are? It closed after just 3 months, and I remember following the story from afar, and it was striking to see how much glee there was that it had failed. And I asked Kwame why he thought that was.
I can't be the, you know, I don't know everyone's motive for everything, you know, but for me and how it felt, it was about my age and it was about my race. That hatred that I saw for people like wanting to see this thing crash and burn. I didn't really get it. And those are the only things that I can think of based off of my life history. You know, I started a business. I was young. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but I started a business at the same time.
Yeah.
And I created jobs for people. I didn't understand the backlash. So my mind only goes to the two places that it can for that. Because
It comes from something beyond
deeper
the situation
than me putting a price point on a menu, you know, because you can either come and eat or you don't have to. I wasn't like, I didn't change the price of the HIV pill or something, you know, like I didn't do something that is necessary for people.
Right.
So
there's a moment where you meet a TV producer before you're on Top Chef. Mm-hmm. And I think the situation was you had like a little bit of a tryout, you cooked a meal for her. And at that point you had graduated from culinary school. You had worked at two of the top restaurants in New York City, literally the world, two of the top restaurants in the world. You cook this refined chef-y food. And she puts down her fork and says, Kwame, that meal is amazing. Here's the problem with casting you. America's not ready to see a black chef cook this kind of food. Mm-hmm. America wants to see black chefs cooking fried chicken and collard greens.
Yeah.
When you say you think the backlash to your opening a tasting menu restaurant could possibly be about race, is that idea? It's like, how dare you?
Yeah. It's not the people don't want to see this. You're not
doing
the
thing you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. You're not staying in your lane.
Yeah.
Essentially. And I don't, I think I came across in the book, like I didn't feel like she was being, you stay in your lane. She was like, listen, I'm a TV producer. This is what I've been, this is what the field is telling me. This is very unfortunate.
Sure.
And this is going to come off as harsh, but this is what show business wants. Yeah.
Don't shoot the messenger.
Yeah, exactly.
We're racist. Yeah,
exactly. But yeah, I mean, that's the honest truth of it, you know, and it's real.
Yeah.
It's real. People don't want to talk about it. I mean, it's uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable topic.
Yeah.
But I've been through it. So I have nothing else to do but talk about it at this point. Mm. Talk about my experiences. And hopefully the next young chef, period, or chef of color, or, you know, LGBT chef, or anything that's a little bit different than the norm, tries to do something that is also a little bit different than the norm, they won't receive the same backlash that I did.
Or at least can't do it without.
Yeah.
Or at least that backlash can't exist without, not precedence of people talking about the fact that, hey, remember last time,
yeah. Right?
But let me ask you this. So that restaurant closed, Shaw Bijou closed, you put years of your life into it. Closed in 3 months, mm-hmm. which is, even from an outside observer's standpoint, a shockingly short amount of time. I can only imagine what it felt like for you. That also wasn't that long ago. Mm-mm. And now here you are. You have three new restaurants. Your flagship one, if I can call it that, Kith & Kin, has been fabulously received. You've gotten great reviews. How is it then that you were able to make a comeback and so quickly?
Let me be clear about it. There are a lot of people that wanted to see me fail, but there were a lot of people that wanted to see me succeed as well.
Sure.
You know? So, like, I think opening the doors to Kith & Kin, for one, it's a more accessible price point, for sure. Mm-hmm. There's more seats. I mean, I had, 29 seats at the Shaw Bijou or something like that? You know, I have 29 seats in my bar at Kith & Kin.
Right.
So, like, there are more people to come in and experience it, which is a great thing. And I think the amount of people that we're feeding every day on a busy day, we'll do 1,000 covers, you know? On a slow day, we'll do 300 covers. And this is, I'm talking all day dining, because we have three services. It's
breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah, we have the opportunity to reach a lot of people. A lot of people have the chance to try my food. And I don't think when I opened up Kith & Kin 7 months after the Shaw Bijou closed, 7-8 months, maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, people want to say I wasn't ready for the Shaw Bijou, but now I'm ready for Kith & Kin. When people, like, I've been getting these questions a lot. What did you do differently this time around than mm-hmm. the Shaw Bijou? I mean, the Shaw Bijou, okay, I created station manuals for all of my cooks. I did the same thing at Kith & Kin. I researched all my purveyors. I went to the farms and all these. I did the same thing for Kith & Kin, for Shaw Bijou. You know, I had extensive training sessions for both. You know, I vetted people. I did tastings with people to create the perfect team. Did the same thing for the last restaurant. I spent a little bit more time researching people that were backing the restaurant. Mm. And that's what I did differently. But this whole now you're ready. It was 7 months after.
Yeah, I'm the same guy.
I'm pretty much, I mean, my hair grew a little bit for sure. I was able to grow my beard out because I wasn't shaving it every day, like Shabiju. But, you know, I gained experience in, you know, I would say management for sure from the Shabiju. But I think the most important thing was the team I put together to do Kith and Kin was different than the Shabiju. And I'm one man, you know. It's more than me when it comes to the success and failure of something. Of course, my name is on the marquee, so like my head's on the chopping block, I get it. But the team that you surround yourself with is extremely important when doing any venture.
Yeah. It's funny because when we talk about chefs and we talk about what the chefs do, it's always in this frame of this person's the hero. And for you to talk about your team like that, how does this team compare, I guess, to the teams who were at the restaurants you came up in, that you worked in?
Well, that's a loaded question. But
I tried to take the loading out of it. But.
I think, for one, my team is very diverse. You know, Black people, Brown people, people that have, you know, from Hispanic descent. I haven't seen a restaurant that has had this much diversity in its staff, and it's refreshing. You know, I think, you know,
at all layers.
Yeah, yeah. Right. You have it in the dining room. You have it in our management staff. You have it in the kitchen, you know, and I think it's an inherent guard letdown with me at the helm. It's not like they have to put on this facade. It's not like they have to think about doing the right thing, being too much of themselves or they'll be fired. Mm-hmm. They can be themselves. I'm not like using the word you people or anything like that. It's like, guys, let's focus. That's it. I'm not thinking about the topic of their conversation or like ostracizing them because they're talking about a certain genre of music that I don't vibe with. It's the same for me for all. I try to keep it very professional, and it's like that's what's missing, I think, in this industry is more chefs of color at the helm of restaurants. More people in food writing that come from a diverse background. Sure. It doesn't need to be everyone, but you need to have some people in your deck that can relate to certain, you know, aspects of culture that you may not be able to. Food writing, all of these things need to diversify, and then the kitchen will start to diversify. But it's gonna take some time.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kwame.
Thanks for having me.
Kwame Amwachi's book, written with Joshua David Stein, is Notes from a Young Black Chef, and he left us with a recipe for his mom's famous shrimp etouffee. And that's at splendidtable.org.